The Business on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Electric Ireland. Keep your energy costs under control with Ireland's leading business electricity provider.
RTE Radio 1.
Hello again, you're listening to The Business and you can contact us by text to 51551, by phone to 1857 15150, email thebusiness@rte.ie or tweet to @thebusinessRTE. Our next guest has written a book that goes behind the scenes of some of the most powerful financial institutions in the world. The book is called The Alchemists, Inside the Secret World of Central Bankers. The author is Neil Irwin and he joins me now from Washington. Neil, if the book is all about central bankers, why did you call it The Alchemists?
Well, you know, hundreds of years ago, as you say, the alchemists were these people who were convinced they could turn lead or dirt or base materials into gold. But it turned out they really didn't need to do that, because what mankind discovered around the same time is that if you have a central bank, if you have the authority of the state, somebody to run it, and you have a printing press, you can essentially do the same thing. You can turn paper into money, into something that has value. Now, of course, it's not even printing things on paper. It's the click-clack of keyboards and on trading floors in New York and Frankfurt that create money out of thin air. And so that's a remarkable power that these central bankers have, and they really are doing what the alchemists of the past were trying to do. In the U.S., I actually witnessed this happen. I was at the trading floor at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York down on Wall Street in New York City, and it's actually very simple. It's a small room, a conference room, a few traders sitting there with a supervisor behind them watching, and the day I was there, they had an auction and they bought about $3 billion worth of treasury bonds. And they bought those bonds from banks all over the world and put out money to buy those bonds. And that was newly created money. That click-clack on the keyboard that they were doing was creating $3 billion out of thin air. And I think this is something that we don't like to grapple with too much. Money is really an idea. Money is not a physical object. It's a concept of value. And that's a powerful idea that's been used and misused frequently throughout history.
Now, the world keeps changing, you know, even in financial innovation, certainly since the 1980s, has just been exponential. And before then, there were always innovations and so on. Has central banking changed much as a result?
It has, and I think it's really changed a lot in this last 6 years. If you go back in time to 2007, I don't think any of us could have foreseen what a massive role these institutions would take in running the global economy. In Europe, for example, it's been Mario Draghi and the ECB becoming the lender of last resort to really the entire continent, to stand behind the governments of Greece and Spain and Ireland and say, you know, we will do whatever it takes. And if there's a fiscal crisis, we will intervene in the bond markets and prop up these governments. They've also, as a corollary of that, had more of a role in setting policy in those countries. They've essentially insisted that the Greek government, the Italian government, the Spanish government manage their books and manage their finances more according to the ECB's liking. That's a remarkable transition. That's something that never would have been imagined 6 or 7 years ago.
Now, they're a very conservative bunch, really, by nature, central banks. And I presume some of the people who get at the top must be very conservative, because you must be institutionalized somehow to get at the top of your institution. But the first central banker was Swedish, I think you've written in the book. Sounds like a conservative person.
Not exactly. It's funny. The first central banker was in Sweden in the 1650s, and his name was Johan Palmstruck. And he was actually a little bit shady, really. He'd been in a debtor's prison in Amsterdam. He moved to Sweden, changed his name, and reinvented himself. And he was entrusted with the entire Swedish financial system in the 1650s and 60s. He created what was called Stockholm's Banko, the world's first central bank. Now, it failed miserably. They actually had a devaluation and essentially a run on the bank, as we've seen all too much in the last few years. But that was the first example of a run on the bank that led to the creation of what is now the Swedish central bank to this day, the Riksbank. So it had a happy ending for Sweden, but it had a not so happy ending for Johan Palmstruck, who was sentenced to death. The sentence was commuted, but he died in prison anyway. So it was the first adventure in central banking was not necessarily a happy one.
Well, speaking of adventures, one of our most recent one was Jean-Claude Trichet, who is the head of the European Central Bank. You've had a look at him.
I have. He's a fascinating character. He, you know, grew up through the French civil service. He's very much a he thinks of himself as a poet, as a philosopher. He studs his speeches with references to the great authors of European history. He's a very effective bureaucrat, though. That's what his real skill is. It's in guiding a room full of people toward a decision in all of these summits. I mean, remember how many, over and over again, how many summits there were to try and address the Eurozone crisis with the finance ministers, the central bankers. Jean-Claude Trichet was very skilled at guiding those people and twisting arms and getting everybody to agree. That said, he was not successful at really finding a solution to the Eurozone crisis. It was his successor, Mario Draghi, who started in November of 2011, who finally managed that.
And that kind of raises the question with me about the whole nature and of the importance of the personality. If Jean-Claude Trichet was a very good bureaucrat and so on, did everything by the book, in comes Mario Draghi and says, look, we've got to do something possibly not by the book, which is what he did. Is it down to the personality?
I think it is. I think this came down to Mario Draghi was a better economist. He had a better, more realistic understanding of what was really ailing the European economy and what might address it. And the great story is July 26, 2012, Mario Draghi has a speech in London where he says the ECB will do whatever it takes to preserve the euro, and believe me, it'll be enough. It was almost threatening to say it will be enough. He was daring these financial speculators, hedge funds, anybody betting against the future of the eurozone, he was daring them to challenge the ECB and essentially promising that these trillions of euros that are ultimately at the disposal of the ECB would be deployed to keep a dissolution of the eurozone from happening. That was something that Jean-Claude Trichet was never either able or willing to do. And I think, you know, obviously Europe still has many, many problems, but we are in a better spot now than a couple of years ago.
Now, there's an element to which there's a bit of a club going, isn't there? Because they all go for an ease up a couple of times a year to Basel in Switzerland. What's that all about?
Yeah, I was struck in my reporting on this book, learning how much they feel bonds of common trust, the leaders of the leading central banks. So 6 times a year, they descend on Basel, Switzerland. It's the Bank for International Settlements is the name of the location, the institution. I call it the central bank of the central banks. And they join there. They have long sessions debating economics and banking policy and so on. Then on Sunday nights, they go to the 18th floor and have a very good meal. The wine is so good, the joke is it's Grand Cru BIS. But they eat delicious food and have this sense of being part of a club and part of a group that has a common purpose in terms of addressing whatever affects the world economy. Now, the negative view of this would be, oh, it's a secretive cabal and this is a very nasty, scary, conspiratorial thing. I do view it a little differently. I think it's what we saw during this crisis is that the central bankers of our age were able to work with a common purpose and common resolve that, for example, wasn't there in the early 1930s and really led to the Great Depression. So I think there's been a lot to be said for these international central bankers feeling a sense of understanding each other and having a sense of common purpose.
But they still make mistakes, Neil, and they have big ones, and we're still paying the price.
Absolutely. And I think the Irish economy is a prime example. You know, you saw this property boom and you saw a central bank and a regulatory system and a monetary policy that wasn't well addressed to keeping the Irish property boom of the last decade from getting out of hand. And then the banking implosion that happened. I think you see even worse economic result in Greece and Spain. They're still near 30% unemployment. There's no question this entire series of events is a failure of the global central bankers. I think their performance since the crisis struck has been relatively good. Their performance before it struck is a lot to question, and a lot of mistakes were made.
Well, I wonder then why people aren't, I suppose, globally a little bit more angry with central bankers if they have made significant mistakes, which we're all paying the price for. They get away with it.
Yeah, I was struck, for example, when I was in Greece a couple of years ago when things were really one of their darkest times. All the criticism was directed at the IMF and to some degree at Germany. And that's fair enough. And those were key parts of the Troika. But the European Central Bank was a part of the Troika as well and was really a key driver of some of the policies that were causing such misery in the streets of Greece. It's funny. I think because these are technical and kind of obscure sounding institutions, I think people don't pay as much attention as they might otherwise. And I think that's something that, if the last few years has taught us anything, again, it's how much power they have and how much we as citizens need to hold them to account and really question what they do.
Well, now you've taken a very long look at it and you've looked at the historical perspective and so on. No doubt they will have learned more lessons in the last couple of years in their little club in Basel than they have done in probably the previous 30 years, I suppose. What's the future for central banking? What way is it going to head, having had a good look at it like that?
Well, you know, there's no they've crossed the Rubicon in so many ways and in so many directions. In monetary policy, it's now clear they have a much wider range of tools. You know, that not that long ago, monetary policy meant, you know, you raise the interest rate if there's an inflation problem, you cut the interest rate if there's a growth problem. Now there's this whole other set of tools. There's quantitative easing. There's, you know, essentially printing trillions of dollars in money. There's forward guidance. There's telling people what you're going to do in the future. Now that they've pulled out all of these tools, they can't put them back in the closet. And we now know that they exist, and we now have some sense of how they might use them in the future. I think there's no turning back.
Well, the book is called The Alchemists: Inside the Hidden World of Central Bankers. Neil Irwin, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for having me.
The Business. The Business. On RTE Radio 1.